dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Welcome to Binary Revolution Radio. This is episode 166, and today is Tuesday, September 26, 2006. I am your host, Verbal, and today we have a very special guest. Stank Dog, how's it going?
Special as in, like, rides the short bus to the show special?
Something like that. You take that as what you will. But today we have a good show for you. But before I get into the specifics, let's do some housekeeping. The first thing I would like to mention is that, well, first of all, I want to thank you, everyone, for emailing me about the mentorship program. I've gotten a lot of response and a lot of people asking to help out, you know, as mentors. But we do need about 5 or so more mentors because, you know, mentees keep coming in and we're not keeping up with the ratio. So if you have, you know, something you want to teach or anything, you know, if you feel like you can be a mentor, please send an email to mentorship@binrev.com. Most of the things right now are people asking to be mentored in coding and Perl, especially for some reason, but Perl and C and all of that junk. So if you know or know someone who is familiar with that, please tell them to give us an email. Stank, do you have any housekeeping?
I have a quick thing, a very short thing. I mentioned last week on the show that we had gotten our spam woes cleared up, and apparently we don't. We're back on another spam list, so bear with us a little bit. It's not one of the biggest ones, but we are getting some bounces again saying we're on spam, and it's kind of getting on my nerves because it's such a hassle. These things are very, very anal, and they look at the tiniest little things, and it makes it so much work and so much burden to a webmaster of a legitimate site like ours to be able to do something that should be simple and common. I mean, their complaint now is that our mail server identifies itself by IP address. When you issue a hello command, it identifies by IP address instead of a host name. Big fucking deal. So what? I mean, it's the correct IP address. It's the correct host name. That may be common to spammers. I realize that. But single those individual IPs out of the spammers and block them. I mean, giving a false positive on anybody who actually runs a secure server is really pretty freaking stupid, and I'm politely choosing my words, and I'm going to be happy and polite about the whole thing and just say, bear with us, we'll get it solved. We're working on getting our name off of these lists again, and shouldn't take too awful long. We might have to do a little reconfiguring on the mail server just to make the stupid thing bow down to their rules. So that's pretty much all I have to talk about in the housekeeping.
Yes, fuck those guys right in here, evidently. Okay, so we have a ton of shit to do on the show, actually. So I'm going to move right along, and we're going to do some emails. Before I actually start reading some emails, you said you had something regarding this you wanted to talk about. So do you want to your thing?
I just wanted to let people know, and I kind of mentioned it last week. We had a couple emails. We've had quite a few emails, which is fantastic, which is great. I purposely saved a couple this week so that when we had you, because I knew that you were going to be back on the show this week, that you would be actually running the show this week. So I purposely saved a couple of these delayed to have you back on the show to address some of them. And we've kind of done the same again this week. We've gotten quite a few emails, and we're not going to be able to get to all of them on the show. However, I want people to know that we did get them. And some of them were, we had put out a call, let me shorten it. We put out a call last week for if anybody is interested in some of the tools that Quine and I had mentioned on the show. If you wanted more detail on them, we could do some more in-depth analysis of some of these tools. So we got quite a few emails of people saying, yes, I'd like to hear a review of this tool or that tool, which is kind of cool. So we are working on those. We're putting them on the to-do list. And we'll have some, actually have a couple hosts in mind for some of these. So we will be doing those in the future. So we may not read your email on the air, but we did get it and we appreciate it. But, and actually kind of as an aside note here, I guess, it's really easy to like do a little quick review on the on any of these tools or give you a list or a general rundown or even make some kind of how to use whatever this tool is. How do you use Metasploit? How do you use this? And show you it in action. You know, I can do a little presentation, step-by-step video, whatever. But it's actually a little bit different when, because see, we actually like to talk about how things work, why they work the way they do, and maybe even expand on it a little bit in, as far as the applications of some of these tools and some of the nuances about them, some of the you know, possible improvements, problems, or cool features that people might not know. So doing a more in-depth show is not as simple as just saying, oh yeah, we're going to do that next week and read you the FAQ or read you the website. We kind of do it a little bit more in-depth than that. So anybody can throw together something quickly, but we don't want to do that. So we are putting these on the list, and they should be coming up soon, but we are going to put the time into them to make these interesting, because I know on the surface, doing an entire episode on one or two particular tools might not sound as interesting as you may think, but I think if you give it a chance, you might be surprised at some of the information that you will pick up on these. So I just wanted to kind of let people know that we did get their emails, and thank you for that. And then I guess we had a couple specific ones we were going to address on the show tonight.
Yeah, that idea actually is really good, and I'm sure a ton of people are going to want, like, a how-to-use, like, step-by-step thing, you know, for whatever tool that they're interested in. Just makes it easier to get it, you know, start using it and all that stuff. So email specifics, or specific emails, sorry, my brain might not be working correctly, but the first email is from Billy. In regards to the episode on tunneling, he said, without talking about OpenVPN, it literally installs a virtual NIC on your machine and the server, bridging together through an encrypted channel through your real NIC. The channel can even be configured to UDP 53 solely, so that it could look like DNS. It takes maybe 30 minutes to set up the first time, and it's massively powerful in its configuration. I'm actually listed as a major contributor to their open source project. I've sent in various suggestions and some thanks money a couple times, and hopefully someday I can contribute to the code if I ever get the time. If your listeners want to make it an easy, secure VPN connection from their laptop through some wireless access point to port 53 to their home network, they need to know about this. And he gives the site, which is www.openvpn.net. And VPN, and OpenVPN runs on, you know, Linux, Windows, and all the BSDs, OS X, Solaris, and even Pocket. So it runs on, you know, pretty much everything. Actually, Spink, have you ever used OpenVPN before?
I actually have not used OpenVPN at all. I've only used the commercial vendors. I really have never used OpenVPN. I do regret that we didn't mention it, at least on the show for sure, because it is definitely a worthwhile project.
Yeah, I mean, OpenVPN, like Billy said, is kind of like the one to get in the open source world. You know, it supports everything, it runs on everything, and the code is, you know, pretty solid from as far as I can tell, you know, having used it. I mean, I've never actually audited the code or anything. You know, it's stable, it does what it's supposed to do, and you can, like, you know, use all the options that we talked about on that show encrypting with like IPsec or using like SSL or whatever, it works. So if you are looking to use VPNs in, you know, in your own home environment or for your travels or whatever, you should definitely look at OpenVPN.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I feel a little bit bad because we are a big proponent of open source and open projects like this, and we really should have mentioned it, so I feel a little bit bad about that, and we definitely support this. Also, if you want to read more, I chopped the email off a little bit. He just copied and pasted the list of features that came from the website, and I figured we could definitely send our listeners over to openvpn.net and let them read them for themselves for sake of brevity on the show and time spent on email. I thought we'd do that, so... and you're breaking up a little bit on us there, but I think you did mention that there was a Pocket PC port that was in development right now, so that also is something that I think is, at least to me anyway, would be useful if I can get that working on my PDA phone, so I think that's kind of cool.
Which PDA phone do you have, the Trio?
I have the Trio 700, yes, and it's hit and miss sometimes, but that's definitely a topic for... I've beaten that horse to death.
I've
done that to death.
Yeah, sorry if I break up a little bit. I am on a cell phone, and that is probably because I suck at the online. But
you do that. You do suck at the online.
Hopefully at some point I will get a landline, so I will be coming in clear.
And how's your spleen or your liver or your kidneys or whatever it is you have?
If I talk to you on RSV or whatever, you'll know that last week I was MIA because I was in the hospital. I had a ruptured appendix and they had to take that out.
A ruptured what? A ruptured what?
Ruptured appendix.
Appendix, oh, okay.
It's like the little organ that doesn't do anything on your large intestine, but it can get infected and then explode, releasing tasty toxins into your stomach.
Well, I'm holding back a joke about an organ that doesn't do anything, but that's
oh, snap.
Oh, no, he didn't. Actually, I didn't. No, I held it back. So, all right, so how about another email?
Okay. Okay, so then... email is from Voltage X. Hi guys, not going to address this to one particular host. Hi Verbal, after listening to episode 162, I looked up DNS tunneling. I'd had to look at it before, but only found some tools that were really hard to use. One discussion I found was http://tinyurl.com/jxql5. And a potentially helpful site is www.dnstunnel.de. I'm really starting to enjoy BinRev again, especially Stank's comments on what is a hacker. I agree that many people are hackers or have the hacker mentality without realizing it. I guess that's one of the reasons I wear the hacker hat from ThinkGeek, apart from all the funny reactions I get. I could get into more of this religious debate on hackerism, but I'll save it for later. Thanks again to X.
All right. I don't know really what to reply to that. I think that's pretty self-explanatory on my end. Did you have anything to...
No, thanks for writing in, and I guess, you know, thanks for...
Thanks for the links. Thanks for the links, for sure. That tiny URL, JXQL5. Just to repeat it, I was browsing through that earlier, so I think that's something that will definitely help our listeners out.
Yep. Yeah, I'm trying to not get into another discussion about the what is a thing.
Yeah, and that's, we'll move on.
Holding my tongue.
Yeah, well, no, it's all right. We'll move on. That's something we've gone into multiple times. I think our feelings are well known on that. So.
Right. Okay. The next email is from Iron Geek. Hi guys, what Verbal said about Gmail in episode 164 was mostly correct. If you web surf to gmail.com, by default it only encrypts the authentication and interactions thereafter. Do not use SSL/TLS. However, if you set your entry page to https://mail.google.com and log in, everything is encrypted, including email as you sent and receive it from Gmail. Hope that helps. Actually, so we were talking about this before the show, Stank and I, and we tried it out and it works. So that is definitely good to know. It's something I did not know. So what, just to recap, if you didn't get it, iGeek is saying if you just go normally to Gmail, because I always just type in like gmail.com and then go. You know, if you do that, then when you begin, it forces you to log in via HTTPS. And, you know, so that's what we're talking about on episode 4, when we're like, okay, it only encrypts your password, you know, so it doesn't send a clear text. Subsequent emails are over plain text. But he's saying if you go to a different URL to start, that's like the entry page, then it won't kick you out of HTTPS and it'll leave you in it. So all the emails you send and receive, you know, while you're using Gmail will be encrypted. So everyone who uses Gmail, start doing that from now on, and don't go to gmail.com.
Yeah, and part of that is just the browser's behavior in general, by default, I guess, for lack of a better word, is if you don't specifically tell it which protocol to use, it uses HTTP protocol, which makes common sense for 99% of the time, but hard-coding that S in there, that secure HTTP, hard-coding that will tell it to go through a different route and have everything encrypted. And just in case anybody wanted to know, I mean, I mentioned on that episode also that Yahoo will automatically log you in with a secure protocol. It will log you in through SSA or through SSL, but once you're in there, it's sending everything in plain text. So that is still true. If you try the same trick, I just tried it on mail.yahoo.com, it kicks you back out to HTTP, even if you do hard code it. So that is something that is unique to Gmail, and I will say that is definitely a good thing. See, I can say good things about Google sometimes. It's possible.
I also think the actual URL you use is important. If you do like https://gmail.com, I think it also will kick you out. So you have to do, I think, mail.google.com.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah.
So, yes, that is definitely a good tip. Thank you, Iron Geek, for that.
Yeah, I mean, thanks, Iron Geek, for telling us, because I definitely will start doing that. Okay, next email. This is from Anonymous, Stank Company. First off, I've been listening to the show since, well, I don't know, but it's been a long time now. Your show is the shit store, bang, bang, bang. I would like to thank you and your co-host for the time and effort you guys and gals put into it. I do have a question and or idea I was trying to get info on. So I'd be interested in seeing if yourself, co-host, and or listeners have any information on it. I'm trying to find out information regarding the technology Gooba.com is/are using to filter out copyrighted material from their users' uploaded videos. From my understanding, it creates a map, in quotes, of the file and then looks through it, searching for a match of copyrighted maps and removes it. I can see how this is great for them so they don't have issues with the owner of the copyrighted material. I've emailed them and they are unable to comment on it. Any idea what or how it works? I love to create maps of TV ads so they are insto-deletoed.
I think you made up a word there. Insto-deletoed.
Oh, insto-deletoed. Oh,
I like it. It works.
I get it.
Yeah, it
works. That's hilarious.
Now, do you know anything about this site?
Sorry, go ahead.
I said, do you know anything about this Gooba.com?
I know nothing.
Yeah, me either. I got to be honest, I've never looked at it. But I actually have some questions about this myself, and let me bounce these off of you and see what you think, actually.
Okay.
First of all, I'm not sure if am I misunderstanding this? If it creates a map of the file, as he says, and then looks through it, searching for a match of copyrighted maps and removes it. So wouldn't you need copyrighted maps of copyrighted material ahead of time, a database of copyrighted maps somehow? Is that what he's saying in this email?
I think so. I'm not exactly sure because I haven't been to the site.
No, but I'm understanding his explanation, and again, I admit I glanced at the site when I got this email, but I didn't read it too in depth. So right. By all means, if any listeners know it, by all means, email us and radio@binrev.com. Let us know. But here's what I'm wondering. See if I'm thinking incorrectly here. If you have to have the cooperation of everybody sending you their copyright map. Here is a copyright map for XYZ, and I would think you'd need a lot of them. They'd have to send one for every show, every movie, every whatever to be stored in your database. So you'd need a lot of cooperation from the distributors and the people. And then second of all, which is all fine. First of all, that seems like a big obstacle to overcome. Now, I may be misinterpreting the way the site works. I'll admit that. Maybe when you upload something for the first time, you upload it. You upload your mask with it at the same time, or your map with it, excuse me, at the same time. But secondly, wouldn't that be defeated by simply not making a copy of it, but extracting it again or re-encoding it again with a no-loss codec or what? Just kind of I'm not sure what the word is. Recreating the actual bytecode or. I'm not sure I
exactly. Right. So what you're saying is, you know, you can pass it through another filter and maybe down it a little bit or something like that.
It seems to me like this map would be easily, you know, I guess a good thing is a good idea would be you know how if you get past the DRM on iTunes or whatever, is you can burn it to a CD, then use a ripping software to re-rip it back off of said CD, and it's ripped it off without the DRM intact. You're bypassing it that way, and there's no longer the same map. It's a new encoding of your material, but it's still at the quality. And it seems like that would be easy to do here as well, but maybe I'm not understanding properly.
Yeah, just from reading the email, though, it doesn't sound like the best solution. You know, to be honest, it's probably not that good of a solution, and it's not all over the news as the thing to use. But then again, that just might be.
Yeah,
and to say.
Again, I admit that I don't know much about it. So again, if our listeners know it, do you think this might actually make a good? Because it is interesting to me. This might be an interesting research project or somebody in the forums to do, and you know maybe you'll find out something interesting enough to put together an article or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Start a thread and, get some people interested and start poking around at it.
Yeah, even if it's just one or two people, put the research together and see if you can find something there and release it as an article. I'd read it, I find it interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It could turn into a con presentation or something, or whatever you want to do.
You'd be surprised.
I'm sure it's cool.
Yeah, you'd definitely be surprised at what people find interesting. I absolutely, just joking, I'm being very serious. I do find that interesting. I would like to see if somebody finds that out, so.
Yeah.
All right.
Me too. Alrighty. Next email. Matt says, I don't think it's cool to start hitting on people in grocery stores.
Wait a minute.
Apple Store, etc.
You better
preface. They just want to do their shopping, not bothered by some dude.
Wait. I think you ought to preface this and explain what this is in response to.
So if you didn't read, so if you didn't listen to episode 163, 164, I think of the two numbers, my friend Noelani came on the show and she started, we had this little segment where she did dating advice and kind of geek love thing, but from the perspective of, someone who is actually married to a geek and have been dating them for a while. So I asked her, what's the best way to approach someone and how I should start conversation, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what Matt is referring to.
Okay.
Right, so continuing on, he says, second, even if it is so acceptable to do that, I tend to be a little twitchy about things that might be wrong here, admitted. Is there a way to meet women without having to feign ignorance of whatever? First is duplicitous. Second, which is more attractive, someone who knows shit or a buffoon wondering how easy Final Cut Pro is to use. The hard part is to ask questions on an equal footing. I would ask, hey, I'm thinking of getting this. Do you have any experience with it? Is there anything else I should get or need to know? If it's legit, that's fine, but if you're faking it, it's lame. Even my wife thought so. Now, my solution is radically different. Just find a hot hacker chick. We don't have proper picks up yet. I'm working on it. Just been busy with other pursuits. But we were married July 29, 2006.
Yeah, I think we should probably skip the specific URL here or anything, just in case. I'm sure he knew that he was sending this to the radio address, but let's play safe and not read the URL to the pictures.
Yeah. So he posts a URL with photo albums about, pictures of him and his wife. He says, I picked her up in the computer lab. She was a fellow admin at a sister department in the same college. So we met, had classes together, etc. At first, she thought I was an asshole, which I am. But since classes are a captive audience, she had to deal with me and realize that I have redeeming qualities. So I asked her to dinner. Long story short, she spent the night, and we've been together ever since.
Aww.
All right.
So, we need, like, some music playing in the background, some nice sappy...
I know, right? So, Matt, I almost agree with you with the part that you're saying, like, don't pretend like you don't know anything about something and just like, start talking to them. But I think, one of the main things that Noelani was getting at is you need to start a conversation somehow. So if you're in that situation, it's like you're not going to be able to start a conversation by going up to someone and being like, hey, I know about that. Let me tell you some stuff about that thing, that you're holding. But, the other thing is that, if you want to be 100% truthful all the time, that's cool with me, but... I mean, sometimes you just kind of have to get the ball rolling, as they say. But, I mean, whatever works for you, since you have a wife and I do not, maybe you definitely know, maybe you know more than I do. But the other thing I don't really understand your solution is find a hot hacker chick. I think that's what we're trying to do.
Exactly.
But
it's nothing to it. That's the whole thing is... And that's my...
Right.
I agree with what the guy's saying, too. And
right.
But, I mean, the thing is, I don't think he realized... You got lucky. You met her in the computer lab at college, and you got lucky. You landed a good one, I guess it sounds like. But what happens when you're not in college anymore, or there are no hacker chicks in your college or classes? That's the question at hand, for me, anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. Because, a lot of people in general aren't in school, because they're working or whatever, and it's hard to find someone after the fact because you don't have, specific things that you're forced to be at with other people that you don't know.
Right.
I think that's the key here.
And I think he even used the phrase in there, so I don't remember... I thought he used the phrase captive audience, which is exactly what he had, and you don't have that if you're not in a computer lab with this, or in a class where you're with the chicks. So, I mean, he kind of said that in his email, so I guess he didn't realize exactly how lucky he really is. Oh, I'm going to cry. I'm getting reclept. I think you should do another email.
Okay. I'm going to move on before Spang says something more emo.
Ah.
Okay, the next email is from Freak, spelled with a P-H. All right. Just got to EP165. Damn you and your Mac users don't have a right-click statement. LOL. We have the Uber Mighty Mouse, damn it. No buttons, but now biatch. And then he gives a link to the Mighty Mouse.
Which is apple.com/Mighty Mouse. But, yeah, I guess I'll take that one since I made the comment.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is typical Apple. This is typical Macintosh. They're going backwards as usual. Instead of finally adding the second button, and actually third, fourth, fifth buttons that a lot of the new mics have, Apple's taking the buttons away. What the hell are they thinking? They're going the opposite direction. Actually, I'm joking. It's not the Mighty Mouse is their new thing where it clicks, but there's not really an actual visible button that you can see. I don't know if you've seen, you know what, you've seen the Mighty Mouse before. They're new mice before, right?
Yes, I've used one a lot and hate it.
Well, and actually, I'll put you on the spot right now because we've gone into a lot of. See, I have this love-hate relationship with Apple. I love OS X. I love the design of the Apples, especially the PowerBooks, MacBooks, whatever they call them these days. I love the design. I just hate the proprietary nature of them. And because of that, I subsequently hate the ridiculous cost of them. If they were a little bit more reasonably priced, I've been dying to get a Mac. And when the Mac Minis came out, I was dying to get one, but they overpriced the damn things for what you get. So I love Mac, but I hate Mac. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm joking in a lot of the stuff I say. But I'm going to put you on the spot. I don't think you've ever come out on the record and made your feelings. What do you think about Apple and Macintosh? What do you think about Apple?
What? I think if you know me, then you know that I'm a Mac user. I'm looking at my PowerBook right now. I've started using, I mean, I use Apple stuff because of OS X, you know? I never used it before that, OS 9, everything before. But ever since OS X, I mean, that's why I use Apple. And, you know, with the cost, I think they're trying. I mean, to be honest, like, They need to sell boxes, right? Like, Apple is a hardware company, and since they don't have the volume, they have to go with the quality, and the price reflects that. And now, as they gain more, you know, volume with their laptop sales and their workstation sales, you know, like the iMacs and stuff too, they're going in the right direction, I think. Like, the MacBook is what? You can go and get one for, like, $1,300. I mean, that's not that bad. Like, that's definitely much lower than what you could get gotten them before.
Yeah, but
right?
If you compare that and to what you could get for $1,300 in the PC world, you could get a top-of-the-line system.
Right, but the problem is, for me, I'm paying for the software, and, like, not the privilege, but, like, I'm paying for the capability of running OS X on a box. Like, if I buy, you know, some box, actually, I just bought a new workstation for $1,300, like, you know, it's like some crazy AMD, whatever, dual core crap.
What do you mean crap? What do you mean dual core crap?
What?
What do you mean dual core crap?
Well, you know.
It's badass.
No, it is badass. But the thing is, right now, I'm using the CPU to do stuff, generate rainbow tables, and, like, download media files, and, like, do all this junk. But it's not a desktop system. It's a workhorse. Like, I don't want to use GNOME or PDE. Fluxbox or anything else. Like, I've messed with, you know, the BSDs, Linux, and Windows for, like, my GUI desktop, and I can't deal with it. You know, like, OS X gives me the best combination of usability and power that I can get out of any OS.
And I do like my limited experience with OS X. But actually, that poses another question. It's funny this came up because I had kind of this conversation with a couple friends earlier this week. What exactly is... See, Apple... We know Microsoft is in the business of software. They're selling operating systems and Office and packages, server, software, etc. They're not in the hardware business. Dell is clearly in the hardware business, but not in the software business. Apple doesn't know what the fuck they want. They're trying to double dip out of every bucket. They're trying to... The triple dip, if you really want to get down to it. They're making money on software, making money on hardware, and now on intellectual property with iTunes and buying the software and trying to get their hand out and get a cut of that as well. I just really think that if they focus...
iTunes and, like, their whole iPod thing, that's their, like, media section. So, like, that's separate.
Apple.
With the software and hardware, I mean, Apple's always been a hardware company, and they sell their hardware by writing good software. I mean, they don't really make money off the software. Like, You can buy a new version of OS X for like $100.
Same as
for
Windows.
Like $150 or whatever.
Same as Windows.
You know, that's nothing compared to how much Vista is going to cost, you know?
What are you talking about? Vista's going to be $100. It's going to actually, they have low-end versions that are going to be like $59, $79, something like that.
Wait, is that true? Because
there's like
what
five different
ones. It's going to be like $300 at least, but I could just be wrong.
Oh, no. It's definitely, no, there's like five or six or seven maybe different versions. They're going to have a lower-end version for home users. It'll have limited functionality. And wait a minute, don't get me wrong here. I'm not defending Microsoft exactly for stripping stuff out and selling it cheaper, although to a certain extent I do like that idea because you pay for what you use. You shouldn't have to buy a whole lot of stuff you might not use. Now, that's not to justify or deny. I'm just saying that they are equivalent as far as that goes. Let me ask you this. Do you think Apple, do you think if Apple started focusing on selling OS X that ran on x86 architecture or the Intel architecture, which they could now since they're switching to Intel processors, do you think if they started selling OS X that I could install on my Dell, for example, that they'd make money selling the operating system? You think they could be successful?
No, they will never do that. Well, okay.
I didn't say will they. I said do you think they could.
They will not do that in the foreseeable future. I mean, OS X currently runs on Intel processors. I'm running it right now, right? And, you know, like I said before, Apple's a hardware company. They need to sell boxes and make money. They don't sell software. And, you know, Apple has always been very, well, good or bad, depending on which side you're on, about keeping OS X running on Apple hardware only. Like, for a while, they had those, like, clones or whatever. I mean, it was too far back for me to actually remember because I didn't actually use OS X, use Apple stuff then, Macintoshes. But, you know, people try to do that and, you know, Apple came down on them with righteous fury because Apple, you know, they need to sell their hardware. And if you can run OS X on Dell boxes, then to be honest, no one's really going to buy Apple boxes because while they look good and, you know,
I don't know.
And it's cool and shiny, but, like, if you can save $1,000 by buying a Dell box instead and running the same software, I think a lot of people would rather do that instead.
I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. Obviously, it's just my opinion, but I think that people would still buy Dell hardware, would still buy Apple hardware and OS X for the simple fact that, yes, you're buying it, I guess, bundled, for lack of a better word. You would get it supported. You know, guaranteed that it's going to run because it is their hardware. But I still don't see why. And again, maybe I'm just being naive. I'll admit that. If they would sell OS X that I can install on my Dell, and they don't, even if they didn't support it, or it's in or whatever with the hardware, just to make it available that I could buy it and run it on a different box, I think they wouldn't really hurt so much their hardware sales. If anything, I think they would increase their software sales that would more than offset any of their hardware losses. I mean, they're at such a small market share now that I think the dividends would be more, but, I mean, that's just a business opinion. Secondly, anybody who's taken basic economics knows that, you know, the change in price is going to increase or decrease the demand, the quantity demanded. I mean, you're going to have a direct relationship. When you lower the price, people are going to want more of them, and when you raise the price, people aren't. And I just don't think they have that ratio to where they're fine, they're stable, they'll sit there and hold on to that 3% market share or 4% or whatever it is, maybe even 5%, not counting the iPods. And that's fine, they'll be stable like that. But I'm just thinking there's a huge opportunity, in my opinion, that they could grow, and I don't know. The other thing that frustrates me is now that they're on Intel architecture, that you're using an Intel processor soon, they're cheaper for them to make, cheaper for them to manufacture. How do they justify not lowering the price by $100 or $200?
What? They are lowering the price. What are you talking about?
Oh, you're crazy. Still make
you're
the comparison.
Crazy.
Still make the comparison to what you would get. It's not even... No, they didn't. They dropped it a little tiny bit, but not enough to make it compatible. Not enough to make it worthwhile. In my opinion, obviously, so I guess we'll lay that to bed for this episode.
Yes. We can talk about this for 4 days.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We've got about, what, like 40-some minutes maybe to jump into our main topic? I don't want to push it along. Are we done with email or no?
Yes, we are done with email.
Okay.
Let's do the main show topic.
All right. And actually, before we do, if I may, I kind of have a follow-up question. I wanted to cover this on our last episode, so I'll just pose it as a question now because I think it's kind of related to this show as well. The last episode that you and I did anyway, which was, 163, we talked about tunneling and VPNs and tunneling in general, the concepts of tunneling, what it is, how it is. Now, I can't help but think and get confused sometimes the difference between tunneling and covert channels, because I heard that buzzword or that term thrown around a lot at DEF CON recently, and I know what covert channels is, but I thought it might be helpful to differentiate for the audience and myself as well kind of the difference between the two, because aren't they pretty closely related or no?
No, not really.
No, okay. Explain covert channels.
So let me talk a little bit about that. So tunneling, we did before, it's kind of like, you know, so tunneling is a trick you play with the headers, right? You don't really have anything to do with the information inside. You're kind of just, okay, I'm trying not to use the word tunnel, but you're trying to pose a packet as another type to send over a different channel that is out of band from what you want to, from the channel you want to communicate, you know, because for whatever reason that we talked about before.
Right.
But now covert channel is more like information hiding. So you're referring to, thanks, so you're referring to the talk that someone gave at DEF CON recently about doing covert channels in IPv6, right?
Well, it was in several places and several different presentations, but that's definitely one that you and I sat in on that, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely one of them, and actually that's kind of why I guess I had it in my head that it's somewhat related here. It's a good topic because we're going to go into some IPv6 stuff later, so yeah,
all
that's,
right,
that's
all
a good...
Right. So for covert channel, like, it's all really about information theory. If you don't know what information theory is, it's a branch of mathematics that deals with, like, information and how it is sent and, like, how it looks and other stuff. So Alan Turing was actually one of the people who kind of did this during the war. A lot, and you know, he kind of made the field actually. There are some other important names in there, but I don't really care. So basically, the deal is this: you have some channel of communication. Let's say you take all the calls that like people make to each other in an area, and then you do something like. Time how long they are, and then you graph it, like against time or something. So what you'll end up with probably is like a bell curve, which is like basically most of the people make calls of a certain duration, like a minute or 2 minutes or something, and then like you'll get like a tapering off where like a few people would make calls a second or 2 seconds.
Hold on. You broke up really bad there. You were saying that some people might make a lot of calls that are 2 minutes, but it tapers off for longer. You broke up right there.
Okay, sorry. So what I'm saying is if you have a graph of all the people that make calls in a certain area and you graphed it according to like the time versus the duration or something, like the time at which they made them and how long the call was, then you would probably have a bell curve. So a bell curve means that in the middle you have a lot of people concentrated, and then as you move towards like the end of the graph in either direction, it tapers off and there are less and less people. So what that means for my example is that you have a lot of people making calls that last like some duration of time, like let's say 1 to 2 minutes. Then you have, you know, as like your time, the duration of the call goes like higher, you have less and less people making calls of that duration. So there could be, like, only a few people making calls that were, like, you know, 10 to 20 minutes, or, like, a few people making calls that were, like, you know, 2 to 4 seconds or something, right?
Right, on each extreme end of the curve is what you're saying, the extreme ends of low and the extreme ends of high.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So that is kind of like, you know, that's information theory stuff, is you kind of look at how information about, like, nature and how all that stuff is analyzed and, like, what you expect to see. So covert channels are basically hiding information in a kind of the sea of information that's already out there. So, I mean, like, if you can imagine, that was very useful during the war and stuff, where they had, you know, they wanted to transmit messages about, like, killing pirates and sinking ships or whatever, like, while, you know, so the other side doesn't, you know that they're sending information. But now, in this day and age, what we're doing with covert channels is hiding information in what appears to be legitimate data. Now, so let's say we had that example with the curve, right? With the bell curve. Now, if it were some other kind of traffic, like IP traffic or whatever, you have some sort of distribution that when you look at it, you're like, okay, this looks like legitimate traffic. Like, you know, because you know, like, let's say it's what we were talking about with the phone calls, so you know it's supposed to look like a bell curve. So say at some point, someone is doing something weird, and they're trying to send extra information, and they're, like, making a lot of phone calls that last a long time, right? So then if you plot that graph again, then you won't get a nice, smooth curve. You'll get a curve and then, like, bump somewhere. And if you do that, then what that's going to do is, you know, alert someone that you're sending something that you're not supposed to. So in that case, you have to use, you know, some sort of, if you want to use some sort of covert channel, you have to do something mathematically to get the curve to look the same. Now,
right.
The curve really relates to, in real life, like, you know, posing your actual legitimate traffic, I mean, posing your illegitimate traffic into something that's legitimate. So let's, you know, one example of this application is steganography. Now, steganography is hiding information in pictures. So then, you know, like, Frank, you were asking me before, how does this relate to covert channels and stuff, right?
Right.
But the thing is, let's say I send you a picture, right? And if someone intercepts that, it just looks like a picture. Now, unless they do a lot of, you know, tweaking and, like, looking at the bits, they're not going to know that I've hid a message in the picture. So in steganography, you end up hiding your information in, like, the high order bits, I think, or the low order bits, one of those. And the change to that image file is not perceivable by the human eye. So what happens is if the receiver knows that the image has a special, you know, encoding in it, so it has some message, then he or she can extract it. But now, that relates to, you know, a bunch of other stuff, too. So you can do that in everything, but mostly, if you're talking about, like, networks and sending, like, traffic on the Internet, et cetera, you're talking about probably hiding information in packets, right?
Right.
Now, what you can do is, so you look at a packet, and some legitimate packet, let's say it's some IP packet, doing HTTP or something, to make a covert channel out of that packet, what you need to do is modify the contents of that packet without making it seem like you did, which sounds kind of weird, but, you know, there are a lot of places in the IP packets that you can add stuff. So, for example, if you have, like, the IPv4 header, you have the type of service bits that's used for, like, QoS and all of that stuff. QoS is quality of service. So But most routers today don't use them. So if you have a packet and it goes through, it just ignores the TOS bits. And that's like 3 bits, I think, or something. And that's some, you know, that's like one place you can put your information. Now, either side has to know that you're sending, you know, your information in the TOS bits.
Right.
But, right. So, well, but, wait a minute, all that is predetermined.
Isn't
but I mean, there are all these places that you can hide things, and it would look as though it was a legitimate packet to someone who's just like, passively monitoring traffic.
Right, right. I get what you're saying. I think it's clear. But now, but is QoS the best example? Because I thought QoS is actually still very much used, especially in the age of VoIP. Isn't that what a lot of cable companies that are offering VoIP phones, that's how they're guaranteeing bandwidth, is because they are prioritizing those packets with the QoS bit. And I thought that was still very much in use. I don't know if... I mean, there's...
I know what you're saying, but I don't think that's true for some reason. Like a lot of people, but a lot of routers just ignore those bits because they don't use them. I mean, things could be changing because of, like you said, the VoIP stuff, but I don't think that's true, but I could be wrong.
Well, actually, and you've already opened up, actually, we should probably segue into the main topic, I would think, now, as time keeps on running here. But I think that basically, if I can oversimplify this, it sounds like basically the difference between tunneling is that you're redirecting packets, whereas with covert channels, you're actually injecting extra data in packets with the goal of sending that data quietly, covertly, secretly to another destination, someone else, to yourself, another server you've got somewhere or whatever. You're actually injecting extra data into your packets instead of simply redirecting or changing the types of packets that you're sending. Is that good?
Yeah, that's a good summary.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
All right, well, that's they're kind of sort of similar, but not. I guess they're only similar in that they both are deal with details in with the packet itself and how the packet is formed and directed and stuff. So I guess that's where I guess I sometimes get the two related, even though they're not. But I still don't know that steganography is... I kind of see the same thing. You're hiding data, but I don't know. One's transport and one's a file.
Application.
Yeah, they feel a little bit different.
Well, I mean, you can hide data anywhere.
Like, yeah, they work the same way.
Covert channels doesn't even have to be over the network. Like, if you're on some system... that's like, you know, some military system or whatever that uses access control list or whatever, then you can, you know, let's say me and you, right, have access to that system, but you're like a general and I'm like some janitor, right? Then we can have a covert channel that between us to leak, like for you to leak in top secret information to me, without, you know, me actually without the other people actually knowing it. So, like, for example, We can have some pre-agreed thing where it's like, okay, if I, like, you know, write some memory to some obscure section in you know, not obscure section, but like some predefined section in my RAM, in the system's RAM,
then
that stands for something. So, like, it's not just networking. It's also in OSs and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I got you. I see it. It's not necessarily networking. It can be anywhere. It's the same principle being applied in different places. I gotcha.
Okay, so let's go to the main topic then, if now we have this covered. Tonight's main topic is going to be about IPv4 versus IPv6. Now, I know that's been done a ton of times, but the thing I want to kind of emphasize on is not so much me or Stang saying, like, V4 is better or V6 is better, but more, like, tell the viewers the differences, the key differences between the two and kind of letting them decide. Because, to be honest, I don't really have an opinion 100%. Like, I lean toward one, but that's just me. And I think it's better if you get, you know, the information yourself and decide for yourself.
Well,
because the thing is, I see a lot of people, like, they'll read some article or someone will tell them that, like, oh, V6 is better because there's more addresses, or, like, V6 is more secure, or something like that.
Right. And
like,
you know,
they'll just go with that and then spread that around, and, you know, without actually understanding why or whether it's true at all.
Yeah, and actually, I guess we're going to have to rush this into 20 minutes, I think, but maybe, I don't know, would it be better, can I start, like, with a little quick, like, a very quick discussion of IPv4 as it is now? Now meaning the most predominant, you know, IPv4, which has been around for a while. Gosh, how can I do this quickly? All right, I'll tell you what. First of all, go back and listen to go back and listen to episode 164. I think we did this, right?
Yeah.
I think. Where we talked about the relationship between TCP and IP. Because everybody talks about TCP/IP like it's one big thing, but there is a distinction between the two of them, and I think it would take too much time to go into it again or recap it, but the long and short of it is that the internet, the IP is the internet protocol, and the TCP, the transfer control protocol, do two different things. They certainly work cooperatively, but it's the IP part that we're really going to focus on, thus IPv4, IPv6, right?
Yep.
Well, IP addresses and IPv4, okay, basically that's what we all know and are used to and have been used to for years. That's those four nodes, those, you know, number.number.number.number addresses that we all see. And that's IPv4 in action, and that's used for addressing, of knowing where servers are, how to get to them, how to route to them, as they're handed over these switches, this backbone that forms the global interweb as we know it. And I guess I'll briefly kind of mention, too, the different classes of addresses, because that's very much how the routing takes place. It's kind of like, I always use this metaphor and verbal, I don't know if you can chastise me if this is a bad metaphor, but I always use the metaphor of a phone number, the way area codes work in a phone number. If I'm explaining this to non-techies, I'll talk about, you know, that's why different states, different cities, different even regions within big cities like New York have different area codes, so that the phone system knows how to route your call. So that if I make a call from here to, 212 in New York or whatever, 305 Miami or whatever, the phone company is going to know from those first couple of numbers how to direct my phone call to the person on the other end. And I always make that comparison to the same way IP addresses work. Do you think that's a good metaphor?
So when you talk about IP address classes, if you're just going with like the regular Class A, Class B, Class C, Class D address family, then the area code metaphor kind of works.
Right.
But, you know, like all metaphors, it kind of breaks down at some point.
Right.
So you just have to know when it stops working as a metaphor and,
right,
you know,
right,
you have
right,
to
right.
understand what's actually going on.
Yeah, it's definitely not regional, that's for sure. So that doesn't, you know, like area codes are somewhat regional for the most part, although VoIP blurs those lines again, but that's a different topic. But as far as the classes of addresses, you know, Class A address being that first node. And let's say, for example, I don't know, 240. I don't even know who owns that or whatever. But anything that's 240.x.x.x is a Class A address that is assigned to a certain company, usually the big telcos, the big backbone providers, that then are allowed to distribute addresses within that. I'm going to make up an example. This is not a real example, I'm making it up, but let's pretend 240 Class A address is assigned to, Bell South, for example. Bell South serving a large number of clients, whether they be business clients or home users on DSL or whatever, can assign and break that 240 down to whatever they want. And they may subsequently break that down and say, okay, well, we're doing business with this large local ISP, and we own everything that's 240.whatever, so they may say, we're going to sell you or assign you 240.1.x.x and sublet that down to a smaller company. Normally a company is not going to get a Class B address either. Class C maybe, possibly for larger companies, but generally A's and B's are reserved for the large companies to then distribute out. So, understanding that the Class A address, Class B, basically the Class A is the largest, anything under 240.x, you can imagine that goes from 240.1.x.x to 240.255.x.x. So you've got 255 to the third power. That's a lot of fucking addresses in a Class A block. Right?
Okay, yes. That is a lot of addresses. But I mean, like, I mean, I'll get into that later. I don't want to jump into it now. But, you know, we need more addresses, too. Like, that may seem like a lot, and it probably is right now.
Right.
But, I mean, in the future.
Well, and that is.
In the near future.
That is, of course, the reason for the big push to IPv6. Because right now, the total number of addresses you have possible, mathematically. Now, we're not going to get into, as you are well aware, any of the reserved addresses, 10.x, 127.x, all those, a lot of those, some of the 198s are reserved and stuff. We're not going to get into those, but just mathematically, it's a 32-bit address range. So with 32 bits, you have a limited number of possible addresses with the whole thing. So you've got basically, again, mathematically only, 255 to the fourth power. That's 255 times 255 times 255 times 255. Which basically works out to around 4.2, 4.3 billion addresses. Now, again, take a few away from that for reserved addresses, but you're talking a little over 4 billion addresses. Sounds like a lot, like you just said. That sounds like a lot of addresses. But when you say that for the whole...
How many people do we have on the Earth right now?
Oh, my gosh, I wouldn't even know. I'm sure census data, a whole lot more than that. I would imagine so. I would guess. I mean, how many? I don't know. Actually, that's a very good question. I really don't know. But certainly, there's not enough to go around. And I think estimates, and these are, of course, just people's analysis on this or whatever, is saying that we're going to run out around 2009, 2010, somewhere in that range. We're going to run out of IPv4 addresses. So as we're running out, they are coming up.
Well, they keep saying that.
Well, yeah,
but
and I'm not
deal is,
lending any credence.
But the deal is you have NAT.
Well, and that's what I was getting ready to go into. There are actually some solutions to this problem, and NAT is one of them. Dynamic IP addresses, I think, is one that people don't even consider or they overlook a lot. You're reusing addresses. When you get a dynamic address from your local ISP, they may have 5,000 users, but they don't need 5,000 addresses because they might not all be on at the same time. Especially that was true in the dial-up days and the AOLs and stuff like that of the world, the dial-up ISPs. Not everybody's on at the same time, so they can share them and reuse them and just reassign the address to somebody dynamically when it's needed. So your friend may have that IP address in the morning, but he logged off and you log in, you may get that same IP address later. So you can reuse some of those addresses, and that's something I think people overlook. The thing is, wouldn't it be nice, and this is probably a good segue to IPv6, is wouldn't it be nice if everybody had their own address? We'll skip right over IPv5 because that was this totally experimental thing. It was all testing and experimenting, so that didn't really... It's nothing. It's not even worth mentioning. But IPv6 now is, well, you know a whole lot more about it than I do. I know some basics and some statistics. But first of all, it's instead of being 32-bit, which is limited, you have 128 bits to work with, right?
Yeah.
Which
Before we move on, let me just say that... So I went online and looked at how many people there are, and there are like 6.5 billion people right now on the Earth. So,
and if we have
a little more than 4.3.
Yeah, a few.
Right, so, okay, so...
And growing.
There are definitely more addresses, the address space is bigger for IPv6. Now, in V4, you were saying, like, it's 255, 255, 255, 255 per each, you know, octal.
Right.
Now, what that means is that one IPv4 address has 32 bits in it. So when you write, like, you know, the four sections, so each section is 8 bits, which has a range of 0 to 255.
Good, right.
So Yeah, in IPv6, however, each address has 128 bits, and that is 50 octillion addresses.
I don't even know what an octillion is, but that's a whole hell of a lot.
The scientific notation ends up to be like 3.4 times 10 to the 38, whereas a billion is just 10 to the 9.
Wow.
Infinitely. 10 to the 38.
It's such a big number that they don't even try to, like in the beginning they were saying that it would be possible, like this is one of the things touting IPv6, is that every single person in the world will be able to have 100 IP addresses for themselves. You can put one on your coffee maker, on your refrigerator. You can have 5 for your computers. You can just enough that you can hand them out like candy. And basically, effectively, I should say, unlimited. I mean, it's obviously limited, but there's so damn many of them, it's ridiculous. Have you seen the ones about, they're saying that every atom in your human body could have an IP address?
Yeah,
that's
crazy. I thought it was in the universe, but that's probably not true.
There's several different versions.
Every single atom in your body can have an IP address.
Yeah, there's several different things like that.
Which sounds about right.
It's ridiculous.
Well, okay, so think about it this way. It's 2006, and we're like, you know, not that advanced yet in the grander scheme of things.
Some of us.
How many IP, like, if you died right now and you no longer existed, how many like less would the world be using? You know, like, you have boxes everywhere, you have, you know, this and that, whatever, right?
Right.
So it's not, you know, so each person uses a lot of IPs. Oh, and, you know, like, I'm not saying you're going to die, but if
you
as in someone is going to die, then, you know, you would not be using at least, like, 10 IPs. I mean, you have accounts, and you have, like, hosting, or you have boxes, or whatever. So, not only that is, you know, now you're going to get IPs for your Xbox 360, for your PS3, for your coffee maker and all that junk, too. But one thing you have to realize is that there are other things in the world taking up IP addresses the size, like, people and, like, their computers. Like, every single router between you and, like, Pakistan has an IP on the interface.
Excellent point.
So it's not just, like, people. It's all the stuff in between. And, you know, who knows how many of that there are.
Excellent, excellent point.
Interface.
No, I was saying that is an excellent point, and I'm so glad you mentioned that. Excellent point that people overlook. They don't factor in the backbone itself that has needs to keep the whole infrastructure running. It's an excellent point.
All right, cool, thanks. So, like, that too, and all this other junk, right? And, you know, like, I don't have to tell you, like, all these predictions that people make, and they turn out to be grossly, you know, underestimations of what people really need.
Right.
So, kind of like the argument that, oh, this is too much, like, we don't need it, that's gonna probably prove wrong with time, just like most other things in this area. But, you know, the increased address space is not just for, you know, giving people more IP addresses. Like, it definitely does that, but, it, you know, there are other benefits and implications from that.
Let's try to squeeze it all in here if we can.
Like you're saying, Sick. People are kind of limping by on IPv4 and the lack of addresses from with the use of NAT. So, like, my apartment or your house or whatever, you know, we only need one external IP address, and we have NAT on the inside, right?
Right, right.
Right. So the thing with that is, I mean, as you know, that you might have had problems with, like, directly connecting with people. You know, I'm not going to really go into how NAT works, but basically all the machines behind the NAT share an IP address. So when you send some traffic into a NAT, it doesn't really know which box on the inside it needs to go to unless you already have established some state. So, I mean, that's a major problem with NAT that they're trying to solve. But the thing is, you know, if you have IPv6, you don't need to solve that problem. I mean, you can have everyone have an IP address, then you know, then with that, some people are saying, like, oh, there are security concerns, or, you know, there are problems with, like, well, if I can just access every single box and they're not protected by NAT, then, you know, that could screw a lot of people. But the thing is, you know, why NAT was not designed from a security standpoint, like as a tool for security, just like, because, you know, that's like making something not accessible is kind of protecting it, which kind of makes sense, but it's really not, it's not actually inaccessible. It's just kind of like hidden, and it makes it one step harder. And the other thing is, if you don't have NAT and everyone has an IP address, you can still use firewalls and other security devices to protect the machine, you know, that's quote-unquote in your network, inside
right.
your network.
Right, but we probably need to focus on IPv6 specifically,
right.
some of the things,
yeah.
because I don't
yeah,
know if
yeah,
we can
yeah.
fit five more minutes. That's a lot of material.
Right. Okay, so the last thing I want to mention with the address space is in 1984, some people over at MIT wrote this, like, really important paper called The End-to-End Arguments in System Design, and you should definitely go read it. But the crux of it is it's saying that functionality should be implemented in the correct layer of abstraction. So if, you know, the transport layer should only deal with getting packets from one place to one port to another, and you shouldn't, like, stuff any additional functionality in there. If, like, the application layer, some higher layer of abstraction needs, you know, to use something, then they should implement it themselves. And IPv6 is going to allow you to do that because it's going to restore, like, the end-to-end principle back to the Internet where, like, I can access thanks box without having to go through any, like, NAT or any, like, translation stuff.
Right.
Now, right, so I'm going to post that URL onto the show notes so you can read that. But there's another paper called Rethinking the Design of the Internet, the End-to-End Argument versus the Brave New World, which is basically saying, like, okay, well, when they wrote that in 84, you know, some stuff were true, but now things are a little different, so it reevaluates the issue that brings up in, you know, like, the modern times, I guess. So I will put that link in the show notes also, and then you can read it and decide for yourself. Okay, so let's get back to more IPv6 and less other things. If you have V6 addresses, right, so you have more addresses, that means that you can allocate, like, bigger blocks of addresses for each AS. So let's say you run, like, AOL.com, and, you know, they may not have one giant, like, they may not have a class A to give you. So if you need more IP addresses than that, then you might have to run, like, several class C's and a class B, you know, to satisfy your needs. But if they had enough addresses, they can just give you one block of one contiguous block of addresses, and you can run your whole network. So what that's going to do is simplify everyone's routing tables, so you have fewer entries because you can have enough addresses to segment the, you know, basically group everything together, and you won't have, like, fragmentation of your IP addresses for your network. So that is one good thing about V6. I mean, Stank, like, at your work or whatever, do you have to look at, like, router configs and stuff like that? And,
no.
Like, routing tables?
No, not myself, no.
Okay, so I do a lot of times in, like, production networks, and what ends up happening is, like, people have these, like, shit-long, like, 5-meg config files.
Wow.
On, like, their Cisco routers or, like, Juniper or whatever. And it's, like, it's mostly because the network is all over the place and they have to, like, you know, go and, you know, have a bunch of routing rules for different subnets because they couldn't get an actual, like, one subnet for all their stuff. So, okay, so that's one benefit. And the other thing is, like, have you heard people say that IPv6 kind of offers better security from, like, something? I don't know.
I don't know that I've heard. I've heard that it has inherently, that it is inherently more secure, but honestly, I've never heard any explanation why. But that's why,
okay, so,
you know, I don't know that much about IPv6 other than the statistics that get thrown around.
Okay, so now the thing is, when I heard that, like way back in the day, it kind of seemed weird to me because, you know, why would you, like, why would a new IP layer protocol have better security?
Right.
And I think these are like the two things that it is say that people say mean when they say that. The first one is it has a bigger address space again. So what that means is, I mean, as you know, people scan networks all the fucking time.
Right. It makes
you, you put a box out there, and people are scanning, and, you know, if you have a vulnerability, like, you know, like minutes, it'll be picked up. But with a much larger address space, what they're saying is it'll be impractical to scan, you know, to scan networks and do all that stuff. Like, the enumeration will be harder, and it will just be not practical because there's so many addresses. So, like, the kind of hit-to-miss ratio is going to be so great that it's not going to be worth it.
Right. Well, it's a simple concept of brute-forcing a short password versus a longer. You're brute-forcing or scanning, enumerating, through 4.3 billion addresses, 4.2 billion we were talking about earlier, versus 50 octillion try to scan through those. I mean, that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, my opinion on that is just, like, you know, that's not really a security feature. You know, like, people, I mean, like, a number is a number. Like, compared to, I don't know, like, 5,000, 4.3 billion is pretty fucking big, right?
Right.
So, right, so, you know, it's like, at some point, people are going to find clever ways to get around that, or just throw more power at it. I mean, not power, but like throw more boxes that scan addresses at it or something.
Well, will there still be blocks, address blocks, somehow in IPv6?
Yeah, so what happens is you still have the network portion, and you still have like your the host portion, I think they call it. So basically in V4, you have, like, a mask, right? And it's like, okay, the mask tells you how many bits are, like, how long my network is. And, like, so if you do, like, a slash 8, that's, like, class A or whatever. So it's just saying, like, the first 8 bits are my network, and then the rest are the host-specific or network-specific host IPs, right? So they have the exact same thing in V6.
All right. Well, then, I guess if you knew which ones were assigned to a certain place, you could limit your scan to within that. You know, I don't know.
Right.
Do we have
time?
Like,
you can definitely do that. Like, no one's telling you to scan the whole internet.
Verbal,
but
do we still
is,
have time to do all that you want to do on this topic, or should we split this up? I'm not sure if we're going to be able to.
No, I think we have time. Do we have, like, 10 more minutes?
Nope.
Oh. Well, I guess that's not a question. I guess I'll wrap this up next show.
Yeah, I hate breaking stuff up in the middle, but unfortunately, I think, I don't know that we're going to have the time to do it this episode, unfortunately.
Okay, sorry, everyone.
Yeah, I guess some of these tops were biting off too big. We probably should have skipped covert channels or something in the beginning and saved that for a different show.
Yeah, probably. But this is my first time hosting, so
well, I tell you
next
what,
time it'll be better.
And you know what? I take some fault because I was interrupting with questions here and there, but let's I will come up with some specific questions next week on this because I think it's a little bit better to answer some questions on this, Q&A on this. So we'll do, next episode, we'll do some IPv6. This one was mostly covert channels and IPv4, which are definitely related, and so will covert channels and IPv6 based on that presentation we saw at DEF CON. But, yeah, we're going to have to break up IPv6 to another episode. There's just too much to talk about, really.
Yeah, that's true. That's fine. But, like, I would rather do, the show correctly than to rush through it.
Exactly. All right, so, what are we going to do from here then? Shouts?
Oh, so right now, let's do some shouts. Stank, do you have any shouts you want to give out?
I'll give shouts to my regular crew at BR407, the BenRev 407 meeting. I'll give some shout-outs to Chilean hackers from Chile. Got contacts all over the planet, biatch. So I was kind of thinking how funny it would be. I would make a trip around the world one time, sometime in the upcoming years. Maybe make a trip around the world and crash with a different hacker in a different country along the way. kind of do this hack the planet, literally, I guess. Go around the planet and meet a bunch of different people, because so many people in so many different countries that I've met. So shouts to everybody, but Chile is my country of the week. And I guess I'll throw in some shouts to Black Crash. I haven't given him shouts in a while, so that's enough for me.
Chile? I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
Did I say that and laugh?
Okay.
Same on you.
Yeah, I just want to give shouts to my mentee, Crackbin, for writing and debugging his first program in C. Good job.
Woot!
Woo! Do we have a site of the week? I think we do.
How about, let's see, site of the week is not related to the topic exactly at all, actually, but I've been finding myself going to a site called hotdeals.org. That's hotdeals.org. Doing some shopping, they find a bunch of the stuff that's on sale, cool sales, misprices, things like that. So I've been shopping. I bought a 2-gigabyte flash card for, it's like $34, and then a $20 rebate on top of that. So like $15 for a 2-gigabyte flash card. Hells yeah.
Nice. Sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. All right. As always, you can email us at radio@binref.com, or you can email me personally at verbal@binref.com. And the closing music is from Art Ren Space, I'm a Fucking Moron Remix. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, that's... That was some of my comments from a recent show where I even said and made the joke, the comment, somebody's going to remix this into a 3.5-minute song on MySpace. Me saying, I'm a fucking moron. And, yep, sure enough, it came true, so this is hilarious. Closing song for tonight. It's RNY Space, which is an attempt at MySpace. I think it's somebody who wanted to stay anonymous is what it is. They thought I might get mad or something, but I think it's hilarious. So that's going to be our closing music for the week.
All right. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel. I will suck it up and admit I'm a fucking moron. Hey, somebody's going to take that clip and loop it a million times. I'm a fucking moron. Moron. It's already a 3.5-minute song on somebody's MySpace. It's already a 3.5 minute song on somebody's MySpace.